So I titled the talk, The Dharma in a Nutshell. Let me just say a little bit about how that title came into being. I was at a meeting of meditation teachers about a month ago at a relatively new facility we have in our community, the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado. We now have a center in the mountains at about 8,500 feet, called the Rocky Mountain Eco-Dharma Retreat Center, that's designed and intended to be a place that particularly focuses on the relationship between contemplative inner development and engaged spirituality in the world. And for the first time, we brought together about 25 teachers from the Colorado Front Range, and one person who came in from Spain, to talk about how each of us respectively was dealing with the issue of engaged spirituality in the context of our sanghas and the teaching that we were doing. Also how we were working with that issue in our personal lives and personal practices, and what kinds of things we could really do together and as individuals to try to address some of the complex issues that we're faced with as a collective human population on the planet right now. As you might imagine, and as probably many of you have experienced, we started with a lot of grieving, essentially. Because when we sat together and spoke in a personal manner about how we all felt about what we're seeing happen on the planet presently, we just felt the deep sadness and grief and sense of loss that is attendant to what's happening, both politically and environmentally. And that didn't arise particularly as finger-pointing or blaming or judging. It was just an honest acknowledgement of a kind of brokenheartedness and the heartbreak that a lot of us are living with. And that seemed like a necessary way to begin the weekend that we spent together, while at the same time, we recognized that it was an okay place to put up a tent, so to speak, but we didn't want to build a house there and just stop in a place of hopelessness and helplessness. Yeah. So from that beginning, that felt really pretty raw and vulnerable, we had a really beautiful weekend together. We did some good constructive work. It was the first time this particular group had gotten together. There were teachers from all the diverse schools of Buddhist practice, people from a number of different Zen communities, a variety of Tibetan communities, and a number of insight traditions. We broke up into small groups according to particular interests, one of them being how to introduce environmental activism into our sanghas without getting caught up in partisan politics, for example. Another group got together and talked about how to work with issues like the carbon tax in the context of working, quote unquote, within the system. And yet another group got together and very specifically focused on how to work from outside the system. Some of you are perhaps familiar with a group called Extinction Rebellion that basically is focusing its efforts on nonviolent direct action of the same flavor that many of us were involved with in the 60s and the 70s. When I came home from that weekend, I felt like I had a lot of assimilation to do. And in the process of that assimilation and digestion of the weekend, I got in touch with a powerful sense of how incredibly complex the issues are. I also was in touch with the fact that many of us at that gathering were approaching the situation from particular schools of Buddhism with different ideas about what it means to be a practicing Buddhist. Yeah. And so I found myself, when I got in touch with that complexity, I'm getting a little bit lost and feeling a bit off-center and unclear about how I wanted to proceed and how I wanted our community in Boulder to proceed. And what came to mind actually was an important conversation I had with a member of our Sangha about 4.5 years ago, when she had just come back from spending a month at Spirit Rock, the February month of the 2-month retreat they have out there every year. And, you know, this person's been a student and a friend for many years, and we had a good detailed talk about her practice experience. And then near the end of the conversation, she said to me, one of the real high points in this retreat was a talk given by Sally Armstrong, one of the teachers out there. And I said, what was that talk about? And she said it was called The 6-Word Dharma. Right? And she said it really pulled things together for her. And what I realized at that point was that at different points along the way, when I have felt like I was off track or had lost my way temporarily, there have been certain kinds of pith teachings that called me back to the essence of what the Dharma is about. Not the particulars of methodology, and not the debates about Buddhist doctrine, but really that what I call the heart essence of the matter. Right. And I said, well, you know, obviously, would you mind telling me what the 6 words were? Right. And she said, I'd be happy to. And those are the 6 words I want to talk about tonight, because these are the 6 words that for me represent, on one level, the Dharma in a nutshell. The 6 words are pay attention, don't cling, be kind. Pay attention, don't cling, be kind. Yeah? And it was so helpful to me to hear her say that, and I've been working with it since, as a kind of a reset when I feel like I've lost my ground or been unable to see clearly how to go forward. So what I want to talk about tonight are those 6 words and how they might be relevant for some of you and how I've been working with them in my own practice. Pay attention brings to mind the words of a Buddhist teacher who's been very important to me, Joanna Macy. Right? In one of her early books, she talked about paying attention. And she said, if you pay close enough attention to anything, you can't help but fall in love with it. And think about that. I remember the moment my daughter was born after a long labor. And I knew what was going on intellectually leading up to the birth of this child. I took the same biology courses that a lot of you did. But when I actually saw this little baby crowning and then coming into the world and had her handed to me and we put her in a warm water bath, the sense of paying attention and falling in love really made a lot of sense. It's interesting to me that those same words, to some degree, were echoed by a great Jewish mystical teacher named Abraham Joshua Heschel, who started his sentence in the same manner. He said, if you pay close enough attention to anything, you will see its sacredness. And think about your own experience, whether that was looking at a child or through a microscope or at the bird that's outside your kitchen window or a perfect piece of chocolate swirled cheesecake. Right? You can't help but fall in love with it, and you can't help but see its sacredness. But in order to pay attention well, or properly, we have to start by living in our bodies. Right? It's not an accident, I think, that in the Satipatthana Sutta, when the Buddha talked about the four foundations of mindfulness, he started with the body. Right? Because so often in our cerebral way of living and the busyness and overstimulation that we fend off in our day-to-day lives, we find ourselves really not wanting to be in our bodies. We find all kinds of ways and reasons to check out and not actually live an embodied life. Right? I mean, whatever enlightenment is, or awakening, or liberation, or moksha, or any of these terms that we talk about that represent ultimate freedom, whatever those words are pointing toward are basically just nice ideas if they stay conceptual, if they stay neck up. Right? The question is, what does it mean to live an embodied or integrated life in an awakened way? I think of James Joyce, the novelist, in his novel Ulysses. At one point, he describes a character in an incredibly powerful way in one sentence. And that sentence is, "Mr. Duffy lived a small distance from his body." Now, we all know Mr. and Ms. Duffy's, right? Where you can be having a conversation with someone and there's just no one there. Right? And we've all probably been Mr. and Ms. Duffy's from one time to the next. Yeah? But we necessarily have to start by living in our bodies, because that first foundation of mindfulness that the Buddha talked about includes the physical sensations in our bodies, and it includes what are called in the teachings sense contacts. Sounds and smells and other experiences that come in through what the teachings call the sense doors. And if those doors aren't open and we're not receptive, we don't have a sense of vividness or aliveness or connectedness, the sacredness that Abraham Joshua Heschel talked about. Here's an example of what happens when we habitually don't pay attention and don't inhabit our bodies. So this is a short piece that was written by a psychotherapist. When she first came to see me, this woman hadn't been speaking for 3 months. But she was silent in many different ways. Resentful silence. "You do it for me." Agitated silence. "I'm scared." Bored silence. "I have nothing." A kind of interested silence, too, but not knowing how to start. After several months, she began to speak. Now, after a number of years, she spends a great deal of time talking, and she's afraid of silence. There are things, she says, that she doesn't want to know. Any movement into silence from outside or within is really frightening to her now. One day we're in a session and there's a noise outside. She paused and said, "What's that?" I said, "Let's listen." She listened for a moment and asked again, "What is it?" I said again, "Let's listen." And then she exclaimed with total delight, "It's a bird. I haven't heard a bird in years. It's beautiful." I saw it all go by. The noise, the not knowing, and then parenthetically, imagine the condition of one who doesn't know the sound of a bird, her wish to hear, the listening, the sound recognized, the bird. Then there was another long silence, and she looked at me and said, "That's just so beautiful." Waking up, she woke up just for a minute. Right? So learning to listen, both literally and metaphorically, as a sign of sense contact, seems to be a central aspect, thematically, of all the great wisdom traditions. Right? When we really do learn to listen and pay attention, we learn to do so in a way that was elegantly described by the poet and writer Mark Nepo, who reminds us of how beautiful a bridge listening is between formal meditative training on the cushion and what sometimes is called meditation in action, the meditation of daily life, what Tibetans call post-meditation. Yeah? This is Mark's definition of how to listen, which some of you who know Thich Nhat Hanh's work will recognize as what Thay calls deep listening. To listen is to continually give up all expectation and to give our attention completely and freshly to what is before us, not really knowing what we will hear or what that will mean. In the practice of our days, to listen is to lean in softly with a willingness to be changed by what we hear. If you look at our current predicament as a collective on this planet, one of the things that becomes painfully evident really clearly is how little of that kind of listening is happening for us as human beings. Now, if we flip that over and we want to be a little more joyful and a little less grim, we can look at what happens when we do learn to listen, when we do learn to pay attention to ourselves, to our bodies, and by extension, to each other, to our children, to our pets, and hopefully someday to our planet. Again, oftentimes it's the artists who have a particular way of reminding us what it's like to pay attention. Right? This is another poet, Ellen Bass, perhaps familiar to some of you. But note the detail of attention that she captures in this very ordinary episode of life. The poem's called Gate C22. At gate C22 in the Portland airport, a man in a broadband leather hat kissed a woman arriving from Orange County. They kissed and kissed and kissed, long after the other passengers clicked the handles of their carry-ons and wheeled briskly toward short-term parking. The couple stood there, arms wrapped around each other, like he had just staggered off the boat at Ellis Island, like she'd been released at last from ICU, snapped out of a coma, survived bone cancer, and made it down from Annapurna in the only clothes she was wearing. Neither of them was young. His beard was gray. She carried a few extra pounds that you could imagine her saying she had to lose. But they kissed lavish kisses, like the ocean in the early morning, the way it gathers and swells, sucking each rock under, swallowing it again and again. We were all watching. Passengers waiting for the delayed flight to San Jose. The stewardesses, the pilots, the aproned woman icing the Cinnabons, the man selling sunglasses. We couldn't look away. We could taste the kisses crushed in our mouths. But the best part was his face. When he drew back and looked at her, his smile, soft with wonder, almost as though he were a mother still open from giving birth, as your mother must have looked at you, no matter what happened after. If she beat you or left you or you're lonely now, You once lay there, the vernix not yet wiped off, and someone gazed at you as if you were the first sunrise seen from the earth. The whole wing of the airport hushed. All of us trying to slip into that woman's middle-aged body. Her plaid Bermuda shorts, sleeveless blouse, glasses, little gold hoop earrings, tilting our heads up. How rich does it get when we pay attention? How many times a day do people get off planes and experience a warm greeting from a loved one? It's extremely ordinary and truly extraordinary if we have the eyes and the heart to experience it that way. I think we begin to get a felt sense of what Thich Nhat Hanh was talking about when he coined the phrase, the miracle of mindfulness. Because when we pay close attention, right, we're in present moment time. Right? And the mystery, the uncertainty, the open-heartedness of life makes itself known to us. That kind of attention is particularly valuable when we're interested in personal growth. Right? In counseling and psychotherapy, I don't do a lot of clinical psychological work these days, but when I did, I was always intrigued at how important it was for people to learn how to pay attention to their experience in a detailed manner. And when they could do that, when they could actually begin to understand the habitual tendency to turn away and leave presence, all kinds of healing would begin to occur. I had someone come to a retreat that I taught a couple summers ago up at Shambhala Mountain Center in the mountains outside of Fort Collins, Colorado. And this was a relatively new meditator. And on the second day of the retreat, she came to me pretty distressed because she was beginning to get in touch with some traumatic material that was coming to the surface and caught her quite off guard. I recognized that I used to do quite a bit of work with severe trauma. And so we checked in more often than we normally would have during the retreat. And I tried to give her some tools and some sense of confidence that she could work with what was happening and that she could come and see me or my assistant, who was also a psychotherapist, if she needed to. So the next night, after she first came to me, she had a dream in which the trauma that she went through was symbolized by a tiger. And that's how scary and powerful this experience was for her. Long story short, she developed some pretty attuned attention. She stayed with the process. This was a 7-day retreat. Right near the end of the retreat, she wrote me a note, which she later gave me permission to share, because I thought it was such a good example of the benefit that trained attention can bring into our healing process. This is what she wrote. David, this morning I understood. I didn't need to do anything. I needed to behold the tiger. As I did, my point of attention moved to the contact of the chair and my feet. I knew then I was supported by all of the earth. While I observed the tiger and the constriction in my chest and my neck, a child climbed on the back of the tiger. She wrapped her arms around the tiger's neck and sobbed. Soon, there was only the tiger. Then, there was only the child. Then, only the grief and my breath and support. Then, There was only the breath. Thank you. Can you feel that movement? Right? She learned to turn toward, and that her Buddha nature, her capacity for wise, compassionate presence, clearly had the capacity to integrate what she had been through. Right? So we start with paying attention. When we've done that for many, many years, we come to see why the Buddha taught the four foundations the way that he did and how central it is to the practice. Because when we look at really great practitioners, those who write the books we read and who inspire us to practice and deepen our own practice, we see people who have spent literally decades, in many cases, training their hearts and minds to embrace what the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. We let go of any naive notions that as we practice, life is only going to get better and better until it's all good. That may be true on a certain level, but the challenges of life certainly don't disappear as we deepen our practice. What seems to change is our ability to embrace what's happening, turn toward it, and open through it in such a way that we develop a kind of confidence that Tibetans call the lion's roar. When I was in Nepal, my teacher said that when the great yogis would do cave practice and have profound realizations of their own true nature, there would at times be a particular point at which they would experience their true selves as literally indestructible. They would understand that while the body on one level and the personality represented one aspect of who we are, what could be called the relative level, that there was simultaneously another level that different traditions call the absolute. Tibetans call it the ultimate, which is a dimension of our nature that doesn't even live in time and space. It's just pure love and wisdom embodied temporarily in a physical form. And it was said that when the yogis would have that realization as a direct experience, not something they'd read in a book, like I might, right? They would throw their head back and roar like a lion, right? Because they would realize in a very deeply felt way that literally anything life presented could be worked with by that deep nature. Literally anything was workable. Right? Here's one teacher. This is from Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. She writes, "Here I am, a teacher for hundreds and hundreds of students, some who have experienced powerful meditative openings. But that has not been my way. For a long time, this was the hardest thing for me to accept, that, quote, nothing happened. I'm not a person who has big dramatic experiences. For 30 years now, it's simply been a process of practicing without being caught by my own ideas of discouragement or success. I would go for months of intensive training, and no spectacular experience would happen. This was especially hard for me for the first 10 years. But at least I never got trapped into believing I was some kind of special spiritual person, which of course is a sand trap for those of us with dramatic inner lives. Yet somehow something did change. What most transformed me were the endless hours of mindfulness, giving a caring attention to what I was doing. I learned that the inner dropping of burdens was not going to happen for me all in one piece, but over and over again. I simply dropped the burden of my judgments of my fear, of distrust of myself, and of tightness of body and mind. At some point, I discovered how automatically tightness and grasping would come. And with that realization, I started letting go, opening to an appreciation of life and finding a sense of ease. The traditional teachings slowly dawned on me that in reality, there is neither coming nor going. That from the ground of being, nothing ever really happens or will ever happen. Since this was like a confirmation of what I already knew, I became less serious and less concerned about myself, less self-absorbed. My kindness started to deepen. Oddly enough, some of my friends tell me I have become more and more like myself. They say there has been a big change in me, but it wasn't produced by any special event. I guess it's just the fruit of being present over and over. It's that simple. So we have pay attention. The second one, don't cling. Right? I think Joseph Goldstein really captured this one so beautifully. Some of you perhaps who are familiar with Joseph's work have read a book of his called One Dharma. Right? And what Joseph essentially did, for those of you who aren't familiar with him and his writing in this book, is that he looked at a philosophical struggle that he was dealing with that had to do with the fact that for the first several decades of his training, he practiced and studied in the Theravada Buddhist tradition with very respected teachers. And then at a certain point, because a friend and colleague of his, Lama Surya Das, introduced him to Tibetan teachings, Surya Das introduced Joseph to his teacher, a wonderful Tibetan teacher named Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche, in the Dzogchen teaching of Tibetan Buddhism. Joseph then practiced with Rinpoche for quite a number of years, and in part because he was a philosophy major at Columbia years ago, before he was even into meditation, he got caught in a philosophical quandary. And the heart of it was that in Buddhist psychology, the Theravadin view and the Vajrayana view of the Tibetans conflicts around a very specific issue. And without getting boringly academic about it, it has to do with the nature of consciousness and fire engines. No, it doesn't. It has to do with this fundamental issue. The Theravadins claim in their psychological view, the Abhidharma, that you cannot have consciousness without an object. Right? Their analysis of the nature of consciousness basically says that every experience we have involves the sense doors and has three elements to it. That is, a sense object, like the sound of a siren, a sense organ, like the ear, right? And what's called sense consciousness, which is the knowing of the sound through the organ. Right? Does that make sense? Same is true with the eye, right? There's a bell, there's the eye, and there's the knowing of the bell through the eye. So consciousness, according to the Theravadins, can only exist when there's an object. Now, the Tibetan perspective on that is entirely different. And it focuses on what in Tibetan is called Rigpa, which basically is a term for a field of awareness, like an energy field of awareness, which is the basic nature of our heart mind, according to the Tibetans. And its primary characteristic is consciousness, right? Except it's undifferentiated. So it's just an open field of awareness, which according to the Theravadin teachings could not possibly exist. And for Joseph, who was philosophically inclined, this presented a terrible predicament because he had tremendous respect for his Theravadan teachers. And likewise, he did for his Tibetan teacher. And they were completely at odds with what they were saying about the nature of consciousness, which is a really fundamental question for people really involved in Dharma. He spent months struggling with himself, trying to understand how to reconcile this issue. Fortunately, he came to a resolution. And what he realized was that he could look at his meditative experiences and understand that if you stood over here at a particular, if you took a particular perceptual stance and you looked at a certain experience, this is like waves and particles, right? It appeared to be a wave. It appeared to be that the Tibetans were right, right? If you came over here and you looked at it the way the Theravadins were talking about it, you could see it from the other perspective. And in a certain sense, they were both true. And then he had the further realization, which was extremely helpful to him, and by extension to everybody who read his book, that basically you could look at all of the Buddhist teachings as skillful means rather than ontological truths. And what were they skillful means for, becomes the question. And Joseph said what he came to realize, that all of the lists that we study and all the methods and practices that we do were all designed basically to undermine the deeply conditioned tendency to cling to what's impermanent. I loved it. At one point in the book, Joseph said, he said, of all the schools of Buddhism, you can survey all of the many different and diverse schools, you will not find any school of Buddhism that teaches cling. Right? It won't happen. You won't find it. And the Buddha talked about that in no uncertain terms. If we look at the suttas itself, here's what he said. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Listen to that again. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Whoever has heard this has heard all the teachings. Whoever practices this has practiced all the teachings. Whoever realizes this has realized all the teachings. I don't think this is difficult intellectually. Not at all, really. However, experientially, maybe you've noticed, not so easy. You know, probably the most graphic look I got at clinging was when I was sitting in a restaurant with my wife, one of the fancy restaurants in Boulder that we go to for an anniversary or birthday or something like that. And still we have to take a bank loan out to do it. But nonetheless, it's worth it. We want to mark the occasion, right? And I looked over at the next table, and this is where the chocolate swirl cheesecake I mentioned earlier comes into play. It's one of the desserts this place is known for, right? And I looked over at the next table, and there was a couple there, and the woman in the couple was having this chocolate swirl cheesecake for dessert. And at the very beginning, she started out, and there was great delight on her face. Right? Except the sad thing, as a lot of us know, is it started to disappear as she was eating it. Right? So when she got to about the halfway mark, I noticed that she took her knife, and with surgical precision, she was sort of slicing the thinnest pieces of cheesecake you can imagine, very slowly. To get as many bites out of this cheesecake as she possibly could, right? And still, as you would imagine, it ended, right? But the clinging to that sense pleasure was so blatant and so obvious. And to see that pleasure turn into pain, which was how it looked on her face when it was gone, was such a classic teaching on the Four Noble Truths. In a nutshell, so to speak. Right? So what does it mean to cling, right? Well, I think we've all had the experience. Right? I think if you look at your life at this very moment and consider the places in your life where there's suffering, right? Choose one of those just for a moment. We'll do a little thought experiment. Right? It doesn't have to be the heaviest situation. Don't go back to mom or dad. Right? Just choose a place where there's some garden variety suffering. Right? And ask yourself, in relation to that experience, what do I have to let go of? What could this experience be asking you to let go of? And if any self-judgment slips in, just let it go to the background. There'll be time for that later if you want to come back to it. Right? But just notice that almost inevitably where there's suffering, there's some quality of holding on, whether it's to an actual person or a self-concept or a physical object. I mean, I remember that the first time after I got my driver's license at 16, the first time I was allowed to use my mother's car, I took it out on a Friday night to a drive-in restaurant where all of us hung out and tried to find something interesting to do, basically. And when I came out to the parking lot, someone had hit it in the parking lot, and the rear fender was dented, right? And I remember the dukkha I felt at that moment, largely because I knew that no matter what I said, I would not be believed, basically, which is what happened. Yeah? Or I remember years later when I was a college student, right? This was like late 60s, early 70s, and I hadn't cut my hair for 5 years, right? So it's kind of like a little more than now. You know? It's about to here. And I had a Jerry Garcia type beard, and I got a job offer that depended upon my willingness to cut that hair. Right? So I graduated in May of 72, got this really good job offer, agreed that I would clean up my appearance, and then I had the summer off. So I came back to New Orleans. I was at Tulane University at the time. I came back in the fall, and a couple days before the first day of this job training, I had to go and cut this hair. And the grief that I felt around giving up this self-image that had been so much a part, I mean, I was a very committed hippie for a number of years, right? Whatever that means. Well, you know what it means. And I went to this fancy haircutting place in the French Quarter. I figured I could afford to spend a little extra after 5 years on a haircut. And I'm sitting in the waiting room, kind of, you would have thought that my family just died in a train crash. You know, I was so attached to this image. And this haircutter comes out and looks at me, and obviously he'd been through this with many other people. And he picks up the hair that's sort of on my hip, and he looks at me in a very caring way, and he says, "Excuse me, but are you here to get that cut, or did you just come in for an estimate?" And he won my heart right there. And I described my predicament, and he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll cut it to a page boy," he said, which meant nothing to me. But he said, if it doesn't work, just come back. I won't charge you. I'll take it the rest of the way. Right. And the next morning, I went to the first day of training, and I opened the door to this office building, and Tom Thompson, the guy who had hired me, was coming down the stairs, and he saw me coming in, and he just went. So I missed the first morning of training, right? But what was so interesting to me was how attached I was to the image, right? And if you look at how difficult it is when life throws a real curveball our way or something unexpected happens, right? Sometimes it has to do with self-image. I worked with a really brilliant woman at one point in psychotherapy. We worked together about 3 years. She was finishing her doctoral dissertation, got into a car accident and had a brain injury. Right? And when she came out the other side of that car accident, she couldn't read very well. Right? And this was someone who, in many ways, stood out because of her intellect. Right? So she worked with a cognitive therapist who did cognitive retraining neurologically, and she worked with me to work on the way her self-image had changed, right? And how she could befriend herself, her new self, as she was now. Yeah. Right? So clinging is something that we don't want to berate ourselves for, we don't want to criticize ourselves for. It's a natural part of incarnate human life. Right? It's conditioned in many different ways from the time we're born. The good news is that we're educable, we're trainable, and we have an innate capacity for self-transcendence, as well as an innate need to embody our humanity. And in some ways, you could think of the entire spiritual path as being a process of learning to live on two planes of consciousness simultaneously. On the relative level, we have to own and embrace our shadow material, our humanity, our needs and desires and wants and preferences, our anger, our hurt. All of that has to be embraced with compassion. And in the process of doing that, we inevitably have the opportunity to experience our innate self-transcendence, the deeper part of our nature, whether we call that our Buddha nature or our Christ consciousness or our true self or any of these different terms that our fingers pointing toward the moon of our true nature. Right? So if and when we're suffering, in an honest, open-hearted way, to take a look at where we might be holding on or clinging is one of the ways we can get some guidance for how to work with that particular challenge. Right? The last of these six words, right? Pay attention, don't cling, be kind. Right? Be kind. Sounds easy. Right? How many of us, though, actually have a well-developed capacity for self-compassion? I mean, the one value that I've come to see in the epidemic of self-contempt and self-criticism that we have in this culture is the fact that when I was a practicing psychotherapist, so many people came with that problem that it helped my daughter be able to afford tuition for college. You know? That's the one redeeming factor that I can see. Beyond that, generally not so helpful. Right? Because I love poetry, here's a poem that captures the power of this kindness that we're talking about. Right? This is Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. I remember years ago sitting with Jack Kornfield when he was giving a Dharma talk. And at one point he interrupted himself. He was talking about something that was going on in the world that was very painful. And he looked at us and on the verge of tears, he said to us, "Life is so difficult. How can we be anything but kind?" And can you feel that place that knows the truth of that in your heart? So much of what meditation training and practice are about is cultivating kindness, first in relation to ourselves primarily, and then by extension to those we meet when we move out into the world. And when I was teaching at Naropa, we used to use the phrase making friends with yourself on a regular basis. And what that actually means, right? Can we actually open our hearts to ourselves and move beyond the tendency of perfectionism that our culture conditions so deeply? Yeah. It's amazing how much more peaceful and enjoyable and magical our lives become when kindness becomes a lived reality on an increasing basis. We can actually learn to appreciate our quirks, for example. Like, you know, there's a standing joke in my family because my wife's father was a foreman for McDonnell Douglas, building airplanes in California. Excuse me. This man could literally build or fix anything. Absolutely. If he got bored on the weekend, he might add a new chimney to the house. You know, fixed his own cars. And his daughter, my wife, grew up with him teaching her a lot of that stuff. Right? I grew up in a house that was the complete opposite. Right? My skill was knowing who to call, basically. Right? That's how I was trained, right? So, you know, so at one point, I used to mow the lawn every week during the summer, and at one point I was in a hurry, and I put the gasoline where the oil should go in this lawnmower, which turned out to be about a $250 mistake, right? And Marcia told her dad, Jim, about it, right? And he thought it was the funniest thing on planet Earth ever, right? And from that day on, whenever they would talk, he just died a couple years ago at 95. Now Jim would call and they would talk and get caught up. And in every single conversation, he would say, "Has he pulled a David lately?" Just to see what I had broken or couldn't fix, right? And at first, you know, I had this little bit of bristle around the whole thing. And then I just got it. That it was okay, you know, that I didn't have to be perfect at everything. Right? It's just true. Nobody really is, even those people who live in the illusion that they are. Right? And once you learn how to do that, right, you can extend that to others. And people notice that when you have a high degree of self-acceptance and they come into your field, into your presence, they feel accepted and loved and cared for. Here's an example that I love. writer that some of you are perhaps familiar with named Annie Lamott. Right? It's in an article on faith that she talks about. Excuse me. Sometimes faith looks like myopia. I don't see everyone's faults so clearly as I used to, let alone my own. The God of my later years is not interested in my pores or cellulite and hopes that I will stop noticing yours. My vision has blessedly blurred. This is a great advantage when you're trying to live more spiritually, more expansively, more like Zorba the Greek and less like the church lady. For instance, when I sit on my bed right now writing on my iPad, the top roll of tummy sometimes creeps over onto the screen and starts typing away. In the old days, upon noticing this unsought collaboration, I would have decided to start a new diet, or perhaps to end it all. Now I think to myself, who knows, maybe it's got something interesting to add. Can you feel what I'm talking about? I mean, how sweet is that, right? I think it's easiest to learn with children in some cases. Sometimes we have a certain amount of natural tendency to express kindness to kids, assuming we weren't terribly injured as children ourselves. Right? When my daughter was young, she used to love the books of Maurice Sendak, right? Great children's author who, incredibly kind, you could feel it come through these beautiful picture books. This is what he wrote at one point about children. He said, "Once a little boy sent me a charming card with a little drawing. I loved it. I answer all my children's letters, sometimes very hastily, but this one I lingered over. I sent him a card and I drew a picture of a wild thing on it. I wrote to him, 'Dear Jim, I loved your card.' Then I got a letter back from his mother, and she said, quote, 'Jim loved your card so much, he ate it.'" Listen to Maurice now. "That to me was one of the highest compliments I've ever received." He didn't care that it was an original Maurice Sendak drawing or anything. He saw it, he loved it, he ate it. So what am I saying here? Let me allow a little bit of time so we can have some conversation. Right? If and when you come to a point in your life or your spiritual practice when it's not feeling clear about where you want to go or who you see yourself to be or where you are on the path, it can be extremely helpful to let go of some of the particulars and the points of distinction and invite yourself to come back to the heart essence of what the process of awakening is about. Right? Whatever the methods, whatever the philosophical perspectives, whatever the differences across methodologies, whether within Buddhism or between Buddhism and other contemplative wisdom traditions, see if you can reconnect with the essential core of what the teachings are about. And in this case, I've chosen one example of what I'm calling the Dharma in a nutshell that I think you can see applies across many other wisdom and religious traditions as well. Right? We want to learn to pay attention. We want to learn not to cling. And we want to learn to be kind. Right? And when we do, there's a way in which our hearts and the world open up in a very beautiful way. I think it's captured quite nicely by the words I'll close with, and then we'll have some conversation. These were written by Achan Chah, great Thai forest master, who was Jack Kornfield, Ajahn Sumedho's primary teacher. try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of an awakened one.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.